Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Welcome to episode 45 of the PreparedX podcast. Just before we get started, I wanted to let you know that PreparedX, again, is sponsoring the International Crisis Management Conference in Boston this year, which is April 25th of 2018. You're probably familiar that we've sponsored the last couple of years. So if you can get to the conference, we'd love to see you at our booth. And all the information is on crisisconferences.com for the conference. Again, we'll be sponsoring the event this year, 2018, and it's April 25th in Boston. Hopefully we'll see you there. Okay, on to the interview. So in this podcast, I interview Michael Gladstone, who is the manager of crisis and emergency preparedness at WeWork. We spoke about different types of challenges between planning in a high-threat environment to a more of a corporate environment as it relates to crisis management planning. We also touched on social media and data mining software. Michael has some great experience there. And how to improve crisis preparedness and preparedness crisis management teams, as well as his own view on crisis simulation exercises. So we covered a lot of ground in about 30 minutes here. So I think you'll enjoy this one. Here's episode 45 and my interview with Michael Gladstone. Good morning, Michael. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Rob. Very good, thank you.
Just before we get started, for our listeners, could you introduce yourself and just talk for a few moments about your career to date, please?
Sure. I have had a very interesting career. I feel like I'm in my third stage of it. I started out as a New York City public school teacher, realized that being a part of teaching history wasn't as fun as actually going in and being a part of the history itself. So switched and went in to the U.S. government and worked for the U.S. Department of State as a crisis manager for 4 years, covering a wide variety, pretty much the entire globe, but focusing on South and Central Asia and the Western Hemisphere. And then about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I decided it was time to change and left public service and went into the corporate world, and now work for a company called WeWork. And for those who don't know, WeWork is a global office provider. We rent out offices to basically anyone, specifically targeting entrepreneurs and young entrepreneurs who are just starting their businesses, giving them a place and the services to build their business, to grow their ideas. And our services aren't just limited to office space. We try and grow a community here, a community of creators, and also really just try and help people not only make a life and not just make a living. So, and here I'm the manager of crisis and emergency management for our entire global fleet.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. I'd love to get into one of those spaces because, you know, the concept to me is brilliant. So, you know, hopefully, when I come down to New York next, you know, you could show me one of those places. That would be awesome.
Yeah, anytime, definitely.
So I think the real intriguing part one of the intriguing parts of your bio there, you mentioned, you know, the work you did with the government, the State Department. And through that work, I noticed as well through your LinkedIn profile that, you know, those previous positions that you had led to working in some, you know, high threat type environments around the world. And I guess, you know, I'd like to hear from you, you know, how do you compare that work in terms of crisis planning to the work you're doing currently in the corporate space?
I think one of the biggest differences is really how there's a matter of risk being viewed. The time I spent in the corporate world, there's definitely a greater appetite for risk because in the corporate world, you know, a competitive edge that can be gained by being slightly more risk tolerant is really going to pay off in the long run with some big dividends. It doesn't mean, however, that safety and security are not paramount, but whereas in the government, and especially in those high threat environments, sometimes the restrictions that you or your agency are going to be placed upon your personnel are going to be a predominant hindrance to accomplishing a task. You know, if you can't physically go out into an environment, it's much harder to do your job. And in the corporate environment, you try and find a way to overcome risks safely. So when you're crisis planning, you have to say, okay, I know, at least in the government side, I am planning for things that are going to restrict my people from moving around or going to one place or the other. In the corporate environment, you say, how can I plan so that we can safely accept sometimes similar risks and still go on? Another thing I would also say is that in the corporate environment, you're supporting and providing a service to a customer base. Right. And when you plan, you have to posture yourself for what the local government might be doing, as well as what your customers might be doing. Because in the government, you're sort of dictating how things go. In the corporate world, you have to work in the same set of scenarios that the local government provides and what your customers are telling you. If your customers are willing to accept that risk, then you also have to be willing to accept that risk. High threat environments, you make the decision. You say either we're going to do X or we're going to stay back. But in the corporate environment, you have to find that balance between keeping your people and your assets safe, but also keeping the business running. And I think the last big difference that I found is in that high threat environment, you're planning for those events that are low likelihood, but have an extremely high impact. Whereas in the corporate environment, you're planning for things that have a much higher likelihood, but may have a more mitigated impact, such as, you know, a weather system, for example. Sure. And how you're going to respond to that, as opposed to a much less likely scenario, but that could have a devastating impact. One other thing that's really important to distinguish is that the information that you're getting when you're working for the public sector versus in the private sector, sometimes in the public sector, you're getting the information directly from the source. And it's more clear. There's less ambiguity about who it's coming from. In the private sector, you don't always have the tap into those resources anymore. And so you have to rely on third-party vendors of information, on the news media, on technology, on social media. Right. And so you have to be even more of your own analyst to determine what's real and what's not. And I think those are the biggest things that I've found different between crisis planning in the public sphere and crisis planning in the corporate sphere.
Very good, very good. I think it's a great segue into my next question, which is around developing that plan. Are there some core components that make up a plan in your opinion and experience?
Yeah, I think really any plan, regardless of whether you're doing it for the public or private sector, needs four key components. The first would be your emergency response component. The second would be crisis communications. The third would be your crisis management component. And fourth, your recovery component. And starting from the top down, that emergency response component, you're really dealing with sort of the fog of the reality of an incident. You know, things are happening. People are maybe scared. Information is coming in from various different sources. You don't know what's true. You don't know what's false. Everyone wants to know what the real situation is. But the true thing that you have to say as a crisis manager is you take a big, deep breath. You clear your mind and you start acting like a quarterback and say, okay, I have everyone. I can see everything on the field. I have all these different departments who have all these different responsibilities. Who am I going to task to do what? How am I going to make sure that our personnel or our clients are safe? How am I going to ensure that information is going to flow up and down the chain so that people above me and the people on the ground know what's real? Also, they understand what we're doing to assist them. And then figuring out, okay, how can we at the same time we're figuring out and clarifying the reality on the ground, can we move forward and start to plan for the next 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then beyond that, the next hour, 2 hours, 10 hours. And so that's your emergency response component. And it's really the part that gets the heart racing the most. But as a crisis manager, you have to take a deep breath and say, I need to be the one who's very clear-minded here when everybody else who may not have the same experience is clear-headed. And all of this takes a great amount of preparation, because you need to be able to say, you know, if this earthquake happens, a lot of people might freak out. But if it doesn't affect our assets, do we really care?
Right.
Or conversely, if the electricity goes out in one building, is it a crisis? Or is it a crisis when the electricity goes out in all your facilities in an entire city? So those kind of things you have to be very prepared for. And at the same time, you're moving into that crisis communications plan. You're figuring out who's going to be drafting messaging, who is clearing that messaging, as well as figuring out how to best protect your brand. I think a lot of things that when people move from the public to the private sector, brand is a huge component of crisis management as well. How are you protecting your asset, which can be ethereal, this idea that what does the rest of the world think about you? Sometimes that means your inward brand. How are you as a security manager giving information to those people above you and those people down on the ground? But also, how does your clients, your vendors, or the media view you? And can you control that message? Is there a smooth system of who's drafting the messaging, what that messaging says? Have you got those templates out? Who's going to clear it? How fast? In what scenario? Who is your audience? How are you going to get it out there? And ensure that the message that you're sending out is clear and concise. On the flip side, though, you also have to say, if I'm messaging too frequently to the media or my clients or whomever, you're going to get message fatigue. And that's one of the biggest things that we as crisis managers have to worry about. If I constantly am sending updates to whomever, they're going to stop reading them. So you have to understand, what's my rhythm? How much information do I want to give? How much do I want to get right? How much am I willing to say? I know I might be wrong on 5 or 10% of this information, but at least I get the ball rolling. So there's those two components. Crisis management itself, listen, that can be long-term, short-term. It's really about once you've got everybody safe, because that's obviously your first priority. People are your first priority, then your assets are your second priority. When you're getting good information from the local government or from a source on the ground, you can shift your operations towards managing the crisis for the near or medium term. And that can be anything from really ensuring that your employees, that their mental health is in a good place. You give them a place to rest, someone to talk to, because we often forget that the people on the ground, even though they work for you and they say they're okay, they might need someone to talk to about what they've just gone through. You might need to find a place for your clients to continue doing their business. And then once all that is set in stone and you've got a nice rhythm going, you can figure out, how do I get back to business as usual, that recovery part of the plan? And that might be a very interdepartmental type of plan that might say, okay, in the corporate world, you know, you might also be concerned about social impact. How do we help not only get ourselves back to business as usual, but how can we help the community in which we are in get back to business as usual as well? And so those are the big four key components. And a lot of this is really about planning in advance, because there is never going to be a time when that plan works 100%. But if you've written it out and you've tested it and you're interested in managing the crisis and ensuring your people understand the plan, you're going to be light years ahead of if you have no plan whatsoever and you're sort of stuck in the mud and have nowhere to turn, essentially.
Right. Yeah, lots of great information there. You touched on some of the challenges that teams face, and we certainly see something very similar here at PreparedX when we conduct these crisis simulation exercises or we do the work with our clients. So it's really good to hear that some of those challenges are very similar, and decision making appeared to be one of the big challenges that you touched on there. But in your experience, what's the biggest one if you had to pull one out of all the challenges in terms of preparing a team to manage the crisis itself, what would be that one big challenge that you see?
I think the biggest challenge is convincing everyone in your organization that being prepared for a crisis, taking the time out of your normal day, your normal rhythm, to prepare for something that may never have happened to the corporation yet, is that biggest challenge to overcome, because everybody says, it didn't happen here, it won't happen here. And those are the biggest things. It's that attitude where, as many of us know in the crisis world, until there is some sort of catalyst that has that direct impact on a team, the attitude is it's not going to affect us and we don't need to prepare for it. So it's trying to change that attitude. But when that catalyst does occur, you as a crisis manager need to be able to move very quickly because people are going to say, well, we want training today and we want it tomorrow and next week and all around your entire fleet. And especially if you're in a global fleet like we are with multiple headquarters across the globe and hundreds of locations, you are going to have to be able to readily and quickly deploy. Even if you are a single asset, you have to figure out how am I going to satisfy all these new customers. And so as a crisis manager, you have to be consistently preparing and planning in your own vertical so that when everybody wakes up, you are able to deliver and you have great product.
Sure. Yeah, it makes total sense. The next area I want to touch on, and we've asked this question in a couple of recent interviews as well with other experts in various fields as it relates to crisis management. But it's something that is evolving on a almost daily basis now, and that's how technology is really changing the way that organizations prepare and respond to incidents. So, you know, what's your experience with regards to that?
Well, Rob, I'm fairly young in both age, but also in terms of
right.
my long-term career in crisis management. So technology has had a massive impact on how I act as a crisis manager in a number of ways, both good and bad. In the good sense, there's the amount, the first thing is that technology has increased the speed at which we get the information, but also the amount of information that's coming at you. And it's no longer, you know, the daytime news cycle, the nighttime news cycle. It's a 24-hour news cycle. And technology, whether that is through social media technology, whether like applications like Dataminer or Hootsuite or TweetDeck, where you can get everything that anybody ever says instantaneously directed at your phone, whether it's things that the government sponsors and you get notifications from New York City directly on your phone. There's just this huge amount of information and figuring out how do I sort the wheat from the chaff? What is information that I need to use and what is just jargon? And at the same time, you have to worry that just because you're getting the information as the crisis manager, so is everybody else on your team, whether they're executives, your social media folks, people who have nothing to do with crisis and suddenly see this and panic. And so technology has actually made it a little bit harder as a crisis manager because there are more what I like to call false starts. Somebody sees something that is blasted out on social media somehow, and it gets into a mass communication system for the whole company, and people are spinning their wheels and screaming for the crisis manager or security to help. And when you really dig down into it, you realize, well, there's really very little impact here. This is just getting people much more excited than they need to be. But you do have to take those into account, because if you don't nip those things in the bud, they very much spin out of control. And on the flip side, if you do nothing about it, then people, when you are really need their attention, are going to say, well, I don't know who these people are. I haven't talked to them before. Why should I listen to them? So it's been that double-edged sword. Additionally, I would say that it makes us a lot more agile. When the executive suite is demanding information, we can use technology to harvest that information in a much quicker fashion. But on the flip side, they want it even faster. So when you're trying to deduce from 30 or 40 or 50 sources what's going on, you're sort of stuck saying, well, why the executives come down and says, I saw on CNN that X, Y, and Z is happening. Why didn't you tell me beforehand? Well, you know, CNN might be utilizing the exact same sources we are and just publicizing it faster. Sure. And we're dealing with getting information from 40 sources as opposed to two or three on the ground. So it's that very interesting double-edged sword that technology is helping us, but also making the job as a security and crisis manager a little bit harder.
Yeah, makes total sense. And again, we see something very similar. So let's talk about scenarios for a while. You know, are there certain scenarios that concerning you as a professional in the trade right now? I know there's, you know, obviously lots going on around the cyber scene, obviously the physical threat in certain parts of the world, certainly here in North America.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's your experience with that? Are there top three or five that you look at?
So I think the biggest, I would say the top, there are things that you can prepare for and things you can't prepare for. Things like an impending weather system, a protest, political violence. These are typically things that you're going to be able to foresee and do something about and talk with multiple different teams about how you're going to prepare. Those are the things that I think worry me the least because we have time. It's those things that you can't prepare for that are going to come out of nowhere that keep me up at night. Things like natural disasters without warning, volcano eruptions, earthquakes, things like that, where there can be a high impact, not only on infrastructure, but on your personnel, and which you really cannot control. No matter how many drills you do, something can happen where someone's at the wrong place at the wrong time. Those are the things that definitely worry me. Another thing would be holiday periods I find the most stressful. This is because those low likelihood, high impact threats that we spoke about at the top of the interview are honestly, in my opinion, more likely to occur because the people who are going to be interested in perpetrating those acts, whether they're lone wolves, terrorist organizations, whatever you want to call them, they see the holiday period as a great time and a platform to make statements. And when I say holiday period, that isn't the traditional, you know, oh, it's winter, it's the holidays in the United States. Holiday periods throughout the globe are time for anyone to make a statement. So as a security manager that has a global fleet, any holiday period, and so those are constantly occurring, are things that I watch. And that's something that came out of my time in government, learning and understanding what all the major holiday periods are across the globe and understanding how that rhythm flows throughout the calendar year. And finally, I would say, when a company has and especially in the corporate world, when there's a big gathering of the entire company, when there's lots of people in the air at the same time, when there's lots of people concentrated in one place, it's, again, just like technology, that double-edged sword. Conveniently, everybody's in the same space. So if something happens, you have people right there. It's easy to address an issue. But on the flip side, if the incident is occurring to those people in the room, or it's happening at a facility in another part of your fleet and those people aren't there to act, the people who you've relied upon are now taken out of the equation. So you have to honestly think, what are the scenarios that you have to be really cautious about? Right. And I think it's just like any manager, kinetic events happening anywhere. You know, we have a huge presence here in New York City, and there are a lot of kinetic events that happen, whether it's the Port Authority bombing, the Chelsea bombing, or the Halloween attack. Those kind of things always keep us up at night because there isn't really a lot of intelligence out there. These are people who are driven by an ideology, and it's really hard for you to say, well, I can pinpoint who that person is, what they're going to do, and who they're going to target.
Sure. Yeah, it makes total sense. I appreciate that. I'd like to kind of round off with, you know, questions around scenario planning and simulation exercises, tabletop exercises, or other types of exercises. And I'd like to get the opinion of our speakers. So how valuable are they as a tool to help improve, you know, resiliency within an organization?
Yeah. Well, honestly, Rob, I think they're very valuable, especially if you're dealing with an audience that is not a seasoned group of crisis management specialists. You know, when we go to these conferences and everybody's sitting around and you want to run a tabletop exercise, some people are kind of jaded and bored and said, well, I've been doing this my whole life. I know how it goes. I can run the scenario in my head and we'll all be safe. But when you're dealing with a group of people, whether it is people on the lower levels or all the way up to the executive level who haven't had as much experience as you have, these scenarios are invaluable for them because they realize that they realize what they don't know, and also they realize what they aren't prepared for. And they're driven and they're excited at the end of an exercise because it's a simulation, because they now have time to prepare for it. They can take those ideas back to their teams and say, let's come up with a solution for X. Let's come up with a plan for how we're going to address this particular scenario. And then especially those people realize that they're willing to put more time and effort into being prepared because if they haven't been placed in that position of authority, if, for example, the scenario takes out the entire leadership of a region and suddenly it's the people who've only been around for 2 or 3 months who are making the calls, those people are much more driven and much more interested in learning and getting more knowledge because they know this could theoretically happen. I might be the decision maker. And so those scenarios, even though they might be chaotic and they might not have the desired result that you as the crisis manager wanted, have actually really positive effects on your corporation or your entity's ability and willingness to put more effort into being crisis prepared and resilient.
Perfect. It makes total sense. Appreciate that. Well, again, thank you for your time this morning. Have you got any final comments for our listeners? And if they need to contact you, you know, how can they reach out?
Sure. I think just in general, everything I've spoken about is really one of those crisis management in general is one of those things that this is a perishable skill. You need to be constantly preparing. Even if you are the crisis manager, you have to be constantly learning, constantly reading, constantly keeping up and refreshing your skills and refreshing the skills of everybody else. So resting on your laurels in this particular field is not something that can ever be done. If you want to reach us, we're available at www.wework, that's weework.com. You can check out the company's website. And I can be reached at michael.gladstone@wework.com. You can feel free to contact me at any time if you have some questions. And if you're ever interested in seeing a WeWork location somewhere around the globe, feel free to reach out.
I appreciate that. And I will definitely take you up on that when I'm down in New York City next. So again, thank you for your time today. Have a good day.
Fantastic. Thank you, Rob.
Yeah, take care. Bye. That's it for episode 45 of the Prepared X podcast. Can't believe we've managed to do 45 of these now. So if you've got any comments or feedback, we'd love to hear it. Please go to iTunes and rate us. You know, we'd love to hear your feedback on any of the other distribution channels, as well as on our website where we have the podcast. You may be listening to this now. So again, you know, we need that feedback from you. What do you want more of? Are the interviews well received? Go to iTunes and rate us, as well as the other channels. Thanks again. Have a good day.